there. Right, the technology's under control. Let me see if I push the button, what happens? Not much. Oop, that's not me.
That's backwards.
That's backwards. Oh, this is forwards. Very good.
Excellent.
I see it as my role to provide a broad overview of the issues and a somewhat longer-term perspective, and there will undoubtedly be some overlap between what I say and what Robert said, though you'll be comforted to learn I won't be giving you interest rate forecasts. So let me start with a comparison outside Australia. This shows the cumulative percentage increase in house prices in a range of countries, basically from the end of 95 to the end of 2007, so that's 12 years. These countries, almost without exception, are low inflation countries, so the sort of increase that you have seen in consumer prices over this time for these countries is of the order of 30%. So that just gives you a benchmark for comparing how much house prices have risen with how much consumer prices have risen. And it's not universally the case, but it's certainly very widespread that house price increases over this period of time have been much more substantial than consumer price increases. So increases of the order of 150% or 200% are not unusual. And Australia does not stand out in this comparison as looking like an outlier. In fact, we're close to the centre of this pack. So this has been a very broad phenomenon across the OECD, very substantial increases in house prices, and I'm going to talk a little bit about why that might be. So in Australia, over roughly the same period, so end of 2005 to now, these are the increases that we've seen in the capital cities. And again, the consumer price increase over this period of time would have been of the order of 30%. I guess Sydney's is lower than the others simply because Sydney's boom. I mean, there have been subsequent booms, but Sydney's house prices had risen a lot before that period. But nevertheless, it's, again, across all the capital cities of Australia, there's been very substantial price increases. Not only that, there have been substantial price increases not only in the cities but also in the regional towns. So it is not the case that any explanation of this, although the increases in the cities have been somewhat larger than the increases outside the major cities, there has to be some background reason why there have been such large price increases across so many countries, and both within the cities and the country, and regionally, and in the regional centres in Australia. And the key to that, the key to the reason why we've had such big increases, I think, is explained with the benefit of another graph. What this shows is, now these are real, so they've been deflated by consumer prices. We had a period from the early 70s to the mid-80s when real house prices basically tracked real average household income and real construction costs. But since the mid-80s, real house prices have risen much more substantially than either real construction costs or average household incomes. Why is that? It's almost certainly because of the combination of financial deregulation and the return to low inflation. That's a common pattern across a lot of countries, and it's almost certainly the reason for the big increases in house prices. And I'm going to drive that point home with another chart. Here is a picture. It says house prices and ability to pay, and you would be correct in observing that there's nothing to do with ability to pay on there yet. So what we've got there is house prices in four of the big capitals. And what I'm going to overlay on that chart is another line, but I'm going to explain the line before I put it up there. I'm going to give you a line which is ability to pay, and I'm going to tell you how we calculated it. Ability to pay is the value of the house that could be purchased using 30% of average gross household income to service the loan and assuming an 80% loan-to-valuation ratio and a 25-year loan. So I'll go through that again. The line I'm going to show you in a second is the value of the house through time that you could have purchased using 30% of your average of your gross household income, and assuming that you've taken out a loan with a loan-to-valuation ratio of 80% and a 25-year loan. Now, the lines don't line up exactly, nothing like it, but in all cases, the majority of the increase is explained by capacity to pay. Now, that doesn't mean that we had to go and spend that. We didn't have to. We were given the ability by financial deregulation and the big decline in interest rates. We were given the ability collectively to buy bigger homes, to buy more expensive homes. And in principle, we could have taken more overseas trips and not spent it on housing. But in fact, collectively, we did spend it on housing, and we largely drove up house prices in roughly in line with our ability to pay. And I think that reflects largely what Robert was saying. So we've done this to ourselves collectively. The next point I want to make is to do with the location of housing and what house price growth has looked like depending on how close you are to the centre of cities. Now, the dots are postcode, individual postcode data, and the lines are there to help you to help your eye. They are lines of best fit. And what I want to draw your... So what we're showing on the vertical axis is average annual real growth in house prices over long periods of time. So Sydney is 20 years, Melbourne's a bit longer than that. But basically over long periods of time, and the vertical axis shows you the average real growth in house prices. Near the centre of Sydney, we've had house price... near the centre of Sydney, we've had real house price growth for waterside suburbs of 7%. Near the centre of Melbourne, it's also 7%. In fact, it's around that in real terms over long periods of time. Further out, a long way from the CBD, house price growth has been more like half. The rate of increase over these long periods of time. So, although it is true that at the urban fringe, house prices have risen, the rise is very much more substantial near the centre of the cities. In other words, the premium for well-located housing has gone up massively. I'll say that again. In other words, if the rate of growth in real house prices for well-located housing, namely housing near the centre of cities, has gone up massively compared to the increase in house prices further closer to the urban fringe. Now let me turn to another point, another thing that Robert was talking about, which is the rental market. And I think everyone is aware of just how much rental vacancy rates have fallen over time in Australia. It pretty much doesn't matter where you look, rental vacancy rates have fallen very substantially. And so rents as a share of average earnings have gone up a lot, but I guess the really crucial thing which is driving the rental market is the right-hand panel, which shows you the gross rental yield. While investors, or for that matter anyone, was confident of capital gains, they weren't too worried about their gross rental yield. But in a world where people are less confident about capital gains, earning a gross rental yield of a bit over 3% doesn't feel too flash. You've got to expect a fair bit of capital gain to make that worthwhile. And so it's no wonder that rents are rising as they are, namely rapidly, because the gross rental yield is, in a world, if you do not expect significant capital gain, a gross rental yield of a bit over 3% is insufficient to lead to a lot of investment. And indeed, we are seeing very substantial rises in rents. The green line shows you the rate of increase through the year of the dwelling rents part of the CPI. That gives you a measure of the extent to which dwelling rents are rising for the whole stock of rental properties, whereas the rear line is the rate of increase of newly negotiated rents. So that simply shows you what the rents being negotiated now, how much higher rents negotiated now are than rents negotiated a year ago. So they're up about 13%, whereas the whole stock of rents has gone up in terms of it's the rental, the rents on the whole stock of rents of the, on the whole stock of rental properties has gone up something like 7 or 8%. Now I'm going to return to the underlying demand issue, which Robert also talked about, and show you a graphic which I think is quite compelling. I once gave a talk like this and somebody said, but there's nothing on the graph. And there isn't, but there will be. So I'm going to start with building up underlying demand and then show you supply at the very end. So if we think there are going to be a certain number of demolitions through time, and therefore to replace them you need a certain number of dwellings to be built, then you've got natural population growth, which is pretty births minus deaths, not the other way around. And that's pretty constant through time. And then drawing attention to the thing that Robert drew attention to, which is that net migration has gone up very substantially in past years, in recent years, and is expected to continue to expected to continue to be strong. And of course, what we've done in this chart is convert from people to number of dwellings. So you have to divide by the number of people per dwelling, which is why when you have 200,000 immigrants, you don't need 200,000 houses. But we're adding this up. And then the final point has been the long-term trend decline in the number of people per household. So to the extent that there is a gradual decline in the number of people per household, you've got to build new houses to make up for the fact that that you've got that trend change. That's obviously something that can change in the sense that, you know, kids staying with their parents. My children are young enough that I expect them to still be at home, but at some point I'm going to want them to leave. And I'm looking forward to the situation. It's going to be longer than I thought, but I'm coming to terms with that. So in principle, that's the variable in a sense that could that can give. Obviously, a change in behaviour can mean that we do not see over the forecast period a decline in the number of people per household. But anyway, to underline the point that Robert made earlier, our estimate of completions looks like that, and so we are looking at measures of underlying demand that are significantly higher than completions over the next few years. And obviously, the outcomes have to be equal, but that means that something has to give, and it may well be largely in the number of people per household that will simply not fall at the same rate it's been falling more recently. I want to turn, this is my final slide before summing up, I want to turn now to the issue of housing stress. Now, stress is a term used quite often, and there are different definitions. And the definition I'm using here is households who spend more than 30% of their disposable income on rental payments or mortgage repayments. And I think it's a misnomer to call this stress too far up the income distribution. If someone's on $1 million a year and they choose to spend 40% of their income on housing, then good luck to them. And the rest of us should take no interest in it, other than perhaps wanting to get invited for dinner. So we really need to concentrate on the bottom end of the income distribution. And I think it's common to focus on the bottom 40%. But anyway, the point I want to draw to your attention, and maybe you're all well aware of this, is the fact that if you look at the bottom 40% of the income distribution, it is overwhelmingly renters the numbers of renters who are paying more than 30% of their gross income on housing is very substantially higher than the total number of people purchasing. It's a very largely a rental story. Okay, so now I'm just going to sum up. There have been big house price rises over the past decade in many countries, and for Australia in all capital cities and most regional centres, and the reason for that, in my opinion, is the combination of financial deregulation and the achievement of low inflation across the OECD, which has led to, as a consequence, a very big increase in capacity to pay. In Australia, for those in the bottom 40% of the income distribution, most households paying over 30% of their gross income on housing are renting rather than buying a home. And that has important consequences for how we think about public policy. And finally, improving housing affordability over the longer term involves reducing development costs at the urban fringe and raising the effective supply of well-located housing. And the reason I focus on that is because that's the thing that for which there has been this huge and increasing premium. Namely, well-located housing is the thing that is where the well-located housing is where the really big price increases have been. And what are the ways of raising the effective supply of well-located housing? Well, we can't build more land within 5 kilometres of the CBD. It wouldn't matter how many of the bright people in the room you put. There's a certain amount of land within 5 kilometres of the CBD. I guess we could create new CBDs. That would be one possibility. But we need, for that, we need policies to enhance urban consolidation, better urban public transport infrastructure, because if you can't, in principle, well-located housing can be housing that's not so close to the centre of the cities but is easier to get to and therefore becomes well-located not by moving the house but by moving the people, and better use of the existing dwelling stock. And there are a variety of ways that in principle we could better use the existing dwelling stock. Thanks very much.